Thank you very much, Tina. Friends, distinguished guests, it's a great pleasure to be here. I must say, until this very moment, I did not realize quite the play on words involved in the use of that phrase, top model. It strikes me that it reflects somewhat ambiguously on the, first of all, on me as an economist, that I should not see the double meaning, and secondly, on you, the organizers of this meeting, that you should invite someone as ugly as myself to present. But let me congratulate the organizers on this forward-looking meeting, focused as it is on the imperative questions of physical and environmental transformation. In the light of history, these are the issues by which we shall be judged. But what is their connection to those other vulgar questions? Finance, debt, budgets, economic performance, inequality, which so preoccupy us from day to day. Are they entirely separated, one thing over here and the other thing over there? Are they related, but only loosely? Or are they part of a broader common process? And if so, how can we understand the relationship between one and the other? I suppose that that question is why you invited a vulgar economist to speak to you this morning. And I submit that the challenge facing economics in this moment of scholarly disgrace is to come to grips with this question. That the key to having an economics that is worth talking about, a model worth studying, is to grasp the principles that unite these two areas of concern, these two issue domains, the vulgar present and the transcendent future. Conventionally, economics proceeds precisely by taking difficulties of this kind off the table and out of the discussion. Resources are simply not present. If you pick up a textbook, even today in economics, you will see that production is done by capital and labor alone. I suggest trying this at home. Go to your workshop, pick up a machine, and try to make something with just the machine in your hands. You will find that you're missing something there. Fixed capital, although a subject in classical political economy since the 18th century, is missing from the modern notion of capital. Fixed capital is what commits us to particular technologies, such as nuclear power or jet airplanes, or that makes available sustainable alternatives. In the standard model, these capital can be shifted easily back and forth from one to another, but we know this is not true in real life. In the conventional economics, money is unnecessary. Transactions are all of one commodity for another. Prices are all in relative terms. Banks do not exist in the conventional model, or if they do, they are costless, just intermediaries between savers and investors. Uncertainty, which cannot be quantified, is reduced to risk, which can be. And in this way, the future, which we do not know, is changed into the past that we basically understand. The result has been an economics preoccupied with steady states and what might be called equilibrium cycles, in which imbalances and crises are monstrous. They are phenomena beyond the reach of the theory. They are to be ignored in theory and treated with distaste when they happen in real life. There is practically no mainstream economics of resource use, and therefore also none of financial crisis. The economics that we are brought up on resolves, in effect, to the Brownian motion of particles in empty space, devoid of structure, just a few characteristics like temperature and pressure, or if you like, growth and inflation. I only have a few minutes to present what seem to me to be the fundamentals of an alternative approach, and I will just characterize that approach with a single word, which is biophysical. That is to say, we need to think about economic problems in the same way that we think about physical and biological problems routinely, and that has some of the following critical features. First is, you have to make decisions. Investments are necessary to extract resources efficiently from the environment and help determine how this process goes about. You make choices, you are stuck with them. But fixed investment also entails fixed cost. And systems which are highly efficient, which do the best job of extracting resources and yield the highest standards of living, are also vulnerable when the cost of resources rises. So this is a feature of the world, it seems to me, that we cannot escape. Our economies are built to work best when resources are cheap and plentiful. When they become costly and scarce, or when you have to restrict their use for other reasons, including environmental reasons, then you have to deal with the resulting economic difficulty. Because profits, which are the source of growth, will fall more rapidly in a system which is characterized by very high fixed costs, which is not flexible and does not change its direction easily. Big systems, in other words, in Germany, are very efficient, but they are vulnerable under certain circumstances. Second point, uncertainty. Conditions the expectation of profit going forward, and an environment of instability and uncertainty depresses profit expectations and investment and makes life more difficult, lowers the growth rate. This is exactly the same as what happens to fertility under difficult conditions in biological systems. And third point, the financial sector, the banks, exist. They are strategically important, but they impose a very large fixed cost on the system. They are useful when the system is progressive, and they are a drag when the system slows down. So when resource costs rise, profits are squeezed, and the previous reported profit rates cannot be sustained, generally speaking. If it is a requirement of the financial markets that they appear to be sustained, then another element is going to enter into the picture. And that element is financial and accounting fraud. The misstatement of the accounting profits, the misrepresentation of the viability of the system. The system becomes, to use a word that criminologists use, criminogenic. It fosters violations of the laws under these circumstances. Honest business, honesty is enforced, and honest standards are expected when honest business is profitable. Straightforward proposition. When it becomes difficult, then the pressure becomes enormous to bend or break the laws. There is a way to disguise all of this, the squeeze in the short run, and that is to make loans, to extend additional credit to new borrowers. But you can only do that if you relax the lending standards, if you do not expect the borrowers to have the same capacity to repay that they had before. And so the loans under the structure are necessarily going to run into trouble. They're going to cause difficulties. You're going to see financial crises and collapses when the lending becomes due. An economy that is sustaining itself in this way has to be extending credit to borrowers who are under conditions where they are less and less likely to repay. In this sense, Hyman Minsky meets Wynne Godley, the economics of financial instability have to be matched to an economics in which accounting flows and stocks are consistently measured, in which someone's surplus is someone else's deficit. Thus, the mortgage market in the United States in the 2000s, which was the source of the global financial meltdown initially, and the sovereign debt markets in Europe, which are the preoccupying problem at the moment, are manifestations of the same process. Economic inequality fuels the debt cycle. The rich lend to the poor. The poor borrow from the rich. The rich pay themselves, fees, and so forth in the upswing, but they are destined to be unhappy when the loans come due. Someone eventually will be stuck with the loss, and the political decision is who and how quickly is this problem to be resolved before one can begin to move forward. In the 1930s, and from the 1930s to the 1970s, we were rescued. We were rescued by the economic transformation that was the war, and especially by the arrival on the world scene of an age of cheap and boundless resources, particularly oil in Texas and later in the Middle East. So not going to happen again. So we have to think about, in a serious way, and this is what you are here to do, how to reduce the fixed costs of the system, the resource demands, resource-using activity must be reduced as a share of total activity. Resources that we have must be used in a more intelligent, systematically more efficient way. The financial sector, which uses a lot of resources and absorbs a lot of the profitability of the system, cannot recover in its present form and must therefore be restructured. All debt crises eventually end up with write-downs and restructurings and a change in the institutions that offer the debt in the first place. What is the role of the state in this process? It obviously has to be the guiding agents, but the state also has a critical additional function, which is to provide insurance, to provide an element of safety and stability for the broad population, what we call social insurance. And here, there is a paradox. The paradox is that the cheapest way to provide social insurance effectively is to provide it to everybody on a common basis. Everything else involves lower efficiency and higher cost. Cutting back on the instruments of solidarity that were built up on both sides of the Atlantic since the 1930s in the United States and since the war in Europe is a false economy. solidarity is efficient because it helps to stabilize the system, to keep intact a system that would otherwise have an uncontrollable tendency to blow itself apart. We speak sometimes of the New Deal in the United States and its relevance for Europe. And there are those, and my friend Paul Krugman is one of them, who stress that the New Deal was a Keynesian project that involved spending. I think this is not accurate. I think this is not fundamental in any event. The New Deal in the United States had two critical features that go beyond this. The first one was reconstruction of the American periphery, the South, which had not had any economic development since the Civil War, 70 years, by the 1930s, but was rebuilt beginning in the 1930s until it is basically an average part of the American society and economy today. And the second was social insurance, solidarity. Beginning with Social Security and the minimum wage in 1935, and ultimately Medicare, Medicaid, the elements of the American health insurance system in the 1960s, imperfect though they are, these were the great New Deal projects that helped stabilize the economic basis of the entire continental population. And I suggest that as Europeans think about their future, that these elements of the American experience are relevant. I wrote in an op-ed in Deutsche Welle just a couple of days ago that austerity is a deceit. Plainly a policy intended to mislead people into thinking that somehow you can get growth by cutting, that you can have progress through suffering, a kind of atavistic, almost medieval notion that pain leads necessarily to gain. I assure you, no doctor thinks this. That's why we have aspirin and morphine and other drugs. And I wrote also that the alternative which is being offered today, growth, is probably a chimera. That is to say, a false alternative, something which is easy to say, would be wonderful to have, but it's not as though we have a credible way forward in that direction on the basis of our current situation, our current policies, or current policy proposals. It's a difficult problem which we do not necessarily have the means to solve in the physical and environmental circumstances in which we live. Solidarity, on the other hand, is something that we know how to do. It's something in which, in this country, there is a rich tradition of the social market, and something whose principles can be shown to be system stabilizing, efficient, and preserving. If we do not go this way, the result will play out on the biological stage. It will play out in a reduction of fertility and populations over time, which may happen anyway, but it will be much more severe. And the fall in living standards that will induce that will be much more severe than otherwise. The result also will be a breakup of existing political unions, with the consequence that there will be no more coordination of policy and common endeavor. This is not a difficult prediction. We have prototypes. We have placed them perhaps in the back of our memory, but we should be aware, I'm sure all of you are aware, that the spot on which we sit was not very long ago under a different political system and a different hegemonic power than it is today. The 19th century was fully aware of this, and I will close with the hope that economics can be brought at least into the 19th century, if not into the 20th or the 21st, along these lines. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive, stamped on these lifeless things. The hand that mocked and the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear, 'My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.'" Thanks very much indeed.